From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, scenes from the life of an obsessive compulsive, we meet writer Emily Colas. She was consumed by irrational worries and obsessions, fears that her food was poisoned or that she was being invaded by germs. Colas has written a new memoir called Just Checking. Also, a talk about acting and directing with Bob Hoskins. He acted opposite cartoon characters in Who Framed Roger Rabbit and was a sweet-natured con man in Mona Lisa. This year, he starred in the film 24/7. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Mermaid Lane, a new release of previously unheard Woody Guthrie lyrics put to music by British folk singer Billy Bragg. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Supreme Court Chief Justice William Rehnquist has refused to block testimony by White House lawyers who have been ordered to speak before the Monica Lewinsky grand jury. White House attorney Lanny Brewer is now at the courthouse in accordance with a subpoena. NPR's Larry Abramson reports.
The White House had asked the Chief Justice to stop forced testimony by White House lawyer Lanny Brewer, saying such testimony would violate attorney-client privilege. In a verbal decision, the Chief Justice refused to overturn previous rulings that held White House lawyers have their first obligation to the public, not to the president. Independent counsel Kenneth Starr had subpoenaed Brewer to appear today before the grand jury. Lanny Brewer and White House lawyer Bruce Lindsay have already appeared before the grand jury, but have cited attorney-client privilege in refusing to answer certain questions. The White House can still appeal to another Supreme Court justice to block the testimony. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
Texas authorities report that four more people have died as a result of the blistering heat. The state's heat death toll is now 103. Temperatures have exceeded 100 degrees for nearly a month now. But some parts of Texas got a brief respite yesterday. Heavy rain fell in Fort Worth. That is the first measurable precipitation in a month. Meanwhile, Fort Worth crews were able to repair a broken water main that supplies a third of the daily water for one county. The main broke because of heavy demand and extremely dry, shifting soil. Voters in Kansas are going to the polls today, choosing candidates for governor. The popular incumbent, Bill Graves, has had to deal with a primary challenge from within his own Republican Party by the party chairman. Russell Lewis of Kansas Public Radio reports.
Despite a 40 percentage point advantage for Governor Bill Graves in the polls, a predicted low turnout is expected to benefit former state Republican Party chairman David Miller. Miller, a Christian conservative, has used the campaign to pummel Graves on his abortion rights stance.
Kansas is known for three things: aviation, agriculture, and abortion. That's awful. We are the Midwest Mecca for late-term abortions.
Graves, who has one of the highest popularity ratings of any governor, says there's more to this campaign than abortion.
We've had remarkable success in creating jobs. We have the lowest unemployment rate in Kansas in probably the last 25 years. We believe that we've been on the right track for Kansas and have been good for this state.
The winner of the Republican primary will face Democrat Tom Sawyer or Fred Phelps in November. For NPR News, I'm Russell Lewis in Lawrence, Kansas.
Alabama officials are reporting a severe case of food poisoning that has sickened 15 people. One woman is reported near death. Physicians say the woman already had medical problems and the salmonella poisoning made matters worse. Other victims are reported to be in good condition. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are down 88 points at 8,698. Trading is active. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, some early optimism and investor buying helped drive stocks up shortly after the opening bell in New York today. But the rally was brief, NPR's Jack Spear reports.
With the closely watched Dow Jones Industrial Average down more than 500 points off its July 17th high, bargain hunters moved back into the market today. Some firming of the Japanese yen against the dollar also added to Wall Street's early impetus. However, stocks turned quickly mixed. MIBA, the large municipal bond insurer, reported its second quarter net income rose 20% to more than $116 million. Managed healthcare company Humana says second quarter profits were up 24%. Computer networking firm Cisco Systems and online company America Online report earnings later today. Finally, the business group The Conference Board released its index of leading economic indicators for June. It fell by 0.2%. The LEI is a key indicator of economic health 6 to 9 months down the road. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
Governors from seven states are asking President Clinton to help avoid an airline strike. The governor sent the president a letter saying a possible strike by pilots against Northwest Airlines would be widespread and severe. The governors fear losing hundreds of millions of dollars in the first week alone. Talks between the pilots and the airline are supposed to resume the week of August 17th. These talks are intended to be guided by the National Mediation Board. Northwest Airlines has hinted that it could ask President Clinton for an emergency order, blocking a pilot strike if the current cooling-off period ends without an agreement. At 6 minutes past the hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 121 points. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, a place to satisfy existing curiosities and discover new ones. Location information at 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, in for Terry Gross. Emily Colas lived in a dangerous world. She believed that if she ate out at a restaurant, she would be poisoned. She checked her children's clothes for bloodstains every day. She frantically inspected packaged foods for tears and tampering. Emily Colas had obsessive-compulsive disorder, a condition marked by repetitive, irrational thoughts and behaviors that would take over her life. And though her mind terrorized her and drove her into tedious rituals, Colas's frank new memoir, which is called Just Checking, is actually quite funny. She wrote the book after going into therapy and going on Prozac, which has enabled her to get her fears and compulsions under control. Emily Colas is now a single mother of two living in Ann Arbor, Michigan. She told me that many of her fears were about germs, food, and cleanliness.
Yeah, it was really about, finally about catching a disease. And so it was a matter of worrying that there was blood somewhere or that a person might have a cut. If somebody walked by me on the street and then I happened to notice that they were, like, wiping their nose, then I'd think that they clearly had a bloody nose. And so my husband and I would be chasing them down the street to check, to make sure that, you know, that wasn't the case. So it became, you know, just any sorts of way that I can imagine a disease getting into my life. So whether it was some spot on the ground that I assumed was blood or a hypodermic needle on a chair that I might sit on or something like that.
And the fear was that what was sitting there was going to get you.
Exactly.
When you get sick, or perhaps even when you were in the throes of all this and you got sick, did you have some dramatic explanations about what was wrong with you? Did you think you were going to die if you had a common cold, for instance?
Yeah, it was less about dying. I mean, that would have been a relief.
Yeah.
It's that sort of process of dying that, you know, you have a cough and it's clearly TB or, you know, things like that. And I think what you're then able to do is, like, look at all the literature on TB. I mean, I became an expert at all sorts of diseases. And so you think about the incubation period or where you could have come in contact with it or what the symptoms are and, you know, how you'd know if you had this particular disease. And so I'd spend my time thinking about stuff like that.
You write about your parents, and you talk about your father as a kind of control person. That seemed to be important to him, yes?
Yeah, probably. I think, which part are you referring to? And he had his breakfast thing where he, you know, everything was sort of ordered.
He had the same breakfast
every day.
Morning.
And ate it the same way every day. And I would just sort of be transfixed watching him eating his breakfast. But yeah, I think everything had a routine and an order and a structure.
You also describe being put to bed by your mother, who would stand at the doorway and flick the light switch several times. Describe that scene for us.
She would, she didn't actually explain it to me until, like, 5 or 6 years ago what she was actually doing, but she would put me to bed and she'd go to turn the light off and she would just be sitting there flicking the switch just for a very long time. And I just thought she didn't think it was off, but in fact she had to flick it in multiples of four until she described it as until it felt right. So she would just be sitting there flicking it over and over again.
And as a little girl in bed, what did you think was going on?
I wasn't really sure. I didn't know. She was always a somewhat sort of ordered person as well and very neat. And I think there was that sense where I just thought she didn't think it was off. And so she was just sort of checking it to make sure it was off. I didn't realize there was that whole sort of uneasiness in her body and that need for the sort of repetition to kind of calm it.
I want to have you read a section from the book, and this is a kind of a ritual that you developed to help you to go to sleep, but it began with a fear, and it's called counting sheep.
Do you ever feel like your tongue is too big for your mouth? I was lying in bed trying to fall asleep when I started to think my tongue didn't quite fit anymore. Once I started focusing on this, it was all I could think about. I imagined my tongue was expanding in its already close quarters. My body started to tingle. I had trouble breathing, and I began to wonder if a swollen tongue would obstruct breathing through my nose as well. I tried to distract myself by thinking about small things while taking deep breaths. I toyed with the idea of calling my doctor, but felt that familiar pang of embarrassment. What would I say? Since it was so late and his office was closed, I'd have to call his service, give my name, and when the operator asked me what's wrong, say, "I think my tongue is swelling." She might just laugh and hang up the phone, or maybe this really happens and she'd send an ambulance over immediately. I wasn't thrilled with either option. After a few hours of going over my choices, I came to the realization that if my tongue was indeed growing, it was a pretty slow process, and I fell asleep.
And that's Emily Colas reading from her book called Just Checking, Scenes from the Life of an Obsessive Compulsive. When you have a thought like that, and I think many people get irrational thoughts, most people can dismiss them and just say, oh, that's crazy. You didn't have a voice in your head that could dismiss that and say, of course my tongue isn't swelling.
Well, I think that's exactly it. I mean, and that's what I hope, you know, appeals to people. It's that it's a worry, just like anybody has a worry. And somehow you or someone else is able to just make it go away. And I can't do that. And in addition to not being able to do that, I just, you know, get the sort of worries or thoughts just get weirder and weirder. So, you know, you're all of a sudden imagining ground up hypodermic needles in your food. But there's a really normal process from, you know, the start of the worry to that point.
Were you constantly talking yourself into this stuff, out of this stuff?
Constantly. It's sort of all you do. You have these two voices. Well, I probably have more than two voices, but these two were the sort of irrational, you know, going over the worry and thinking about it and spinning on it. And for me, it was sort of thinking of ways in which it probably was safe and that I didn't need to worry. And then there's that sort of rational voice saying, this is insane. Stop thinking about this. You're a nut. Just let it go. So the two of them are sort of constantly fighting. And I think, you know, it's one of the most frustrating parts of this is that you just want to be utterly and totally insane so that you don't know you're spending so much time being a nut. But, the two of them just sort of fight with each other in a way.
In fact, you call it insanity light, that it's not full-blown psychosis or something like that, because there still is this little rational self left.
Right. I mean, I talk about at some point in the book fearing that my food is poisoned, and somebody at one of the readings once said to me, well, that sounds like paranoid schizophrenic. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think some of the parts of the book, you read it and you think, yeah, that's full-on insanity. But I think for the most part, it's, you know, sometimes people say, well, it's just neurotic. So it's almost like neurotic times 1,000. And it doesn't feel like you can say, yeah, this is full on insanity. So sort of the worst of all the worlds.
Yeah.
You know, you're constantly consumed by this and you don't even get to be called crazy. It just seems unfair.
Well, did it seem like it would be easier to be called crazy? Then you wouldn't have to at least fight with yourself about this stuff?
Right, totally. Yeah, there's something, I don't know, something comforting about the fact that someone says, you're a nut job and that's it. But this one, it was sort of like, I know what I'm doing is nutty. So,
well, you have a funny scene. It's also a very poignant scene when you're first dating your husband and he invites you over to dinner to make a lovely meal for you. And you're sitting there while he's preparing the meal and you're thinking, what? You're thinking he's trying to lace your food with poison.
Yeah, that one, can I give the pre-story to that
as
well?
Yes, please.
Because it's not, I was at a party, and this boy was just sitting at a table, and he was eating the sugar cubes off out of the bowl that's sitting on the table. And the hostess said to him, oh my God, don't eat that. It's where we put our acid. And this guy gets this horrified look on his face because by that point he's had like 10 hits of acid. And she starts joking and laughing. And so So all of a sudden, this, you know, I'm like witness to this, and I think, okay, yeah, so that could happen. You know, there's food, nobody's watching it, no one's, you know, tending to it, and it could totally be laced. So then I started to think that, you know, I couldn't necessarily trust what was going to be in my food. So then I personally stopped going to restaurants and all of that and ate prepackaged food, but I couldn't say this to this guy on the second date. So he said, I want to make you dinner, and I thought, okay, fine. And so I was afraid that perhaps he was going to poison my food. And so there became this whole sort of fear about whether or not he did that. He brought the food out. And then he sort of disappeared for a minute. And I thought, well, maybe I should just switch the plates. And then I, you know, sort of went through the whole, you know, if I switched the plates and it was laced, then he'd die. And then the police would come and question me and I'd get in trouble for having, you know, poisoned him. And I didn't even do it. And then, you know, if... So anyway, so eventually he came back and I didn't switch the plates because I thought it was really important to start the relationship on the right foot and trust him. And so I did. And, you know, I sort of waited around after I ate for the drugs to take effect. And when they didn't...
You were okay.
I thought, this guy's a keeper.
Your life is exhausting.
I know.
To read about it. I mean, here you are having this very innocent, innocuous meal with this guy who eventually does marry you, and you've got this whole paranoid fantasy going on.
Yeah, but I mean, it's funny because as you're saying that, I'm thinking also, it's probably tiring for people on the second date to try and, you know, sort of meet a guy and talk about their lives and all of that. So instead of dealing with that sort of intimacy, I sort of spun off on the worries. So in a way, it's probably as tiring as a second date, but that was probably too daunting for me. So it was easier to just, you know, spin on something I was comfortable with, which is, you know, poison and things like that.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to take a short break and then we'll talk some more. And our guest today is Emily Colas, and we're talking about her memoir. It's called Just Checking, Scenes from the Life of an Obsessive Compulsive. I'm Marty Moskowain, and this is Fresh Air. My guest is Emily Colas, and we're talking about her book called Just Checking, Scenes from the Life of an Obsessive Compulsive. What I find interesting is that even though you had all these fears, you got pregnant. You got pregnant twice. And I think for many expectant mothers and fathers, too, there are a lot of hopes and expectations, but there are a lot of natural fears associated with pregnancy, but you did it anyway.
Well, it's like I said before, I think there was that sense of not being certain what to do with myself or what to do with my mind or how to spend all this sort of energy. And there were all these attempts to solve it. And I think the desire to get married and to have children was, you know, the attempt to have a purpose or a role. So that it's not that I thought, okay, I'm so worried, and if I get pregnant, the hormones will surge, and I'll be worried about the fetus, and it'll just be out of control. It was more like, this will distract me. So.
And to do something, quote-unquote, normal, get married and have children, that's what regular people do.
Yeah, then I'm a mother, and I'm normal, and I'll be paying so much attention to being a wife and mother that I won't have time to do these silly, worrying things anymore. But I was wrong.
Well, to the point where when your first baby was born, you became convinced it wasn't yours.
Well, yeah. I mean, she came home. She's so darling. She came home and she was so quiet and she slept all the time and she was just sweet and she never cried. And I thought, there's no way this could be my kid. My kid's going to be like a moody, whiny, complaining bitch. So I thought, well, you know, maybe it's not mine. And then it occurred to me that... When you're leaving the hospital, you're supposed to match up your wristband with the baby's ankle band and check that the numbers are the same and sign something. And I just had a baby, so I was tired and I was out of it. And I assumed that my husband, since he was the official checker anyway, was doing this. But it turns out he wasn't. And so then I, you know, I had my wristband or hers. I can't remember whose I had, but I only had one. So I started checking photos from the hospital to see if any of them were visible, and then thought about blood tests and DNA tests and all of that, because there was no sort of way to determine whether or not she was truly mine.
So what finally convinced you?
She's listening, right? I'm still not sure. Well, I mean, aside from the fact that she looked a lot like us,
right.
There were things like I got teeth at 6 months. I had like 8 teeth at 6 months, and that's unusual. And she had that as well. And I would go to the doctor, and I'd say, we look alike, don't we? And he'd say, yes. And we sort of grew at the same rate. So, I mean, it was those kinds of things that, you know, aside from, you know, and the fact that she looks exactly like me, made me sort of get comfortable with it. But, I mean, it's like, I think I knew she was mine. I mean, there were other things that happened. Like, she was forceps baby, so she had these little marks under her eyes, and she had lots of hair. So it was clear, you know, we recognized her. So it wasn't like, you know, some generic baby. So I think it was, you know, I knew that she was really mine, and because I somewhere fundamentally knew that, it allowed me to sort of go wild with the other stuff. And then I guess when I got tired of that worry, I moved on.
Is that what happens too with some worries, that you just exhaust yourself on them, or they're not as interesting or as provocative as they once were?
Oh yeah, I think absolutely. You know, how many, well, with the baby not being your own, there are lots of different ways in which you can sort of explore that. And then you go through them all and you think, okay, now I'm bored, and you think of something new that you can go off on. So yeah, I think that's exactly what happens.
What got you to the point then of thinking, this is ridiculous, I can't go on with my life like this?
Oh, yeah, the this is ridiculous happened long before the I can't go on with my life. But, you know, at that point, after I'd had my second kid, and my husband and I both thought that, you know, because I had the two in a row, I thought, well, once this isn't, you know, the case anymore, and I'm not responsible for this fetus, then I'll get better. And he thought that as well. And I didn't. Mm-hmm. And so I started to sort of lie to him about it. So I would still be worried, but wouldn't share this stuff with him anymore. And there came this point where we were watching television, and I sort of absentmindedly went to turn the volume up. And when I looked at the screen, I noticed that someone on TV had been in a fight and was spitting blood into the snow. And I became convinced that I had contracted a disease from this encounter. And so much so that I couldn't keep it to myself. And I told him about it. And he was, at first, he like sort of went back into that role of, you know, sort of placating me with, you know, that was taped months ago and any diseases in that blood would be dead. And there was a screen in front of, you know, and he's sort of going on. And then all of a sudden he's like, whoa, wait a minute. This is just way too nuts. And at that point, he, you know, he said, we need to do something about this. And in part, I think there was that going on. And then ultimately, we separated. He just couldn't take it anymore, and he left. And those sort of two things combined sent me into this really horrible depression, because I couldn't function without him. And it got to the point where I thought, you know, you're just out of your mind. This is ridiculous, and your life looks this way that you just didn't imagine it was going to look. And that kind of finally gave me the courage to try the medicine that I was so afraid to take.
Yeah, and you talk about taking that first pill. First of all, what kind of medicine did they prescribe for you?
For me, it was Prozac.
And you were afraid to take it?
Right, because at the time, I mean, maybe it was leading up to this as well, but at the time there were stories in the news about people who had taken Prozac and got on these, like, shooting sprees, and they would say, well, it was the Prozac. And I just thought, great, I'll be, like, a crazy medicated killer, and that's going to, like, suck more than just being crazy. So I was afraid to take it. I mean, there were other side effects, too. They, you know, could have convulsions or things like that, and I just thought it was too daunting. And then it got to the point where I thought, I don't care.
Right.
And so
right.
I took it.
And how did it work on you? I mean, this stuff takes a little time to work into your system.
Right. I think it probably took about 4 to 6 weeks before it did what it needed to do. But what it did in the meantime was made me very tired and kind of numbed my brain, which was perfect. I mean, I slept all the time, and I was like dopey in a way, and it was nice. It sort of quieted my mind in a way that I, you know, I was really happy to have it do. And then over time, I realized that the worries were kind of, they were still there, just like, you know, anybody would have a worry, but they weren't gripping. And I would try and run with them, and I couldn't.
Huh.
So
was there relief in that? But at the same time, you were so used to building your life around all these worries and fears.
Well, yeah, that was sort of the strange part of it. It's like, it's so nice to have that miserable part gone, but there was also a fun part of it as well. I mean, it gave me a lot of stories to tell, and it filled up my brain in a way that I really enjoyed. I mean, I had these really intricate, complicated disease transition models in my head, and all of a sudden they became sort of useless. And so it was like a lot of brain space and not, and I wasn't certain what to do with it, so... Yeah, it was bittersweet.
Well, did life seem kind of dull now that you weren't worried about people putting hypodermic needles in your meals?
That's right. Where are they? It was absolutely, it was totally dull. I mean, I would still think about it. I'd think, okay, this is boring. I need to spice up this meal by thinking of some sort of toxin in it. And it just wouldn't click, and I couldn't. And so I thought, well, what am I going to do with myself? And so at that point, because I had gone on medication, my husband came back. And so we were sort of trying to work on the relationship, and I was trying to figure out what to do with myself and what kind of job I was going to get. And it was all horribly boring and tiresome.
And not kind of what your life used to be in the past.
Right, exactly. And I was sort of like not sure what to do with myself.
Now, how about today? Are you still taking medication?
I'm not. I stopped a few months ago.
Was that scary to go off?
Well, I was always sort of a self-medicator. You know, when I would get worse, I would take more. And when I was feeling better, I would take less. And there were times when I did actually stop, and the worries came back really quickly. And this time, I went off and they didn't. So I sort of knew what to... I knew that if I stopped, they might come back. And I was sort of, you know, trying to keep it in check, as it were. And so far it's been okay, but, you know, I keep that bottle in my medicine chest just in case.
So you monitor your thoughts kind of like, how am I doing today? And do you have someone you can check it out with just to make sure you're not losing
someone it? Like...
I don't know.
A friend. Yeah, well, that's the sort of tricky thing, because that's what, you know, the role I'd put my husband in, and that wasn't particularly useful because there's that sense of wanting to be kind of loving and supportive without being enabling. And so, I try, though not particularly successfully, to keep my friends out of it. But, I guess I sort of do that. And I mean, to this day, the thoughts come into my head. They're just not gripping. So, if something starts to grip me, then I think, okay, can I stop this? Or, you know, is it happening again?
Well, I want to thank you very much, Emily Colas, for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Emily Colas's memoir is called Just Checking. I'm Marty Moskowain, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, British actor Bob Hoskins tells us how he got into the business and about his roles in Who Framed Roger Rabbit and Mona Lisa. Recently, he starred in the film 24/7. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews a new release by Billy Bragg of music he composed from some previously unheard Woody Guthrie lyrics. This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, in for Terry Gross. Bob Hoskins is one of the most versatile actors working today. His roles cover the gamut: a mobster in The Long Good Friday, a sweet-natured small-time hood in Mona Lisa, the hapless private eye Eddie Valiant in Who Framed Roger Rabbit, an overtly gay J. Edgar Hoover in Nixon, and many more. Whether in a leading role or playing a smaller part, Hoskins has the ability to completely inhabit a character, making him one of the best in the business. He's also a busy actor, and this summer appeared in Cousin Bet and will be seen in the upcoming The Live Virgin. Hoskins recently starred in a small black-and-white British film called 24/7. Set in Nottingham, a depressed working-class town in the English Midlands, he plays a boxing coach who worked with a group of local boys. It's a gritty story about young men on the dole, aimless outcasts with no future.
It's interesting to look at some of the films that have come out of England that have this sort of dark, working-class, gritty reality. Even something like The Full Monty, which was taken as a very funny film, but it's actually a film about people on the dole in England.
People.
And the forgotten people, exactly. Mm. And I wonder whether in England filmmakers are trying to offer this alternative view of England, whether there's sort of a social war at work in England, and films are one way to understand it.
No, it's basically what it's come from. For when Maggie Thatcher came into power, as far as Maggie was concerned, like all arts and drama was left wing, and she wasn't
she
having,
no parts
having,
of it.
Having none of that. And she went out of her way to destroy it. And the only films that were made, if the women weren't wearing crinolines, the camera wouldn't work, you know. And now they've gone. The new government is not helping the film industry, but it's not standing in its way.
Mm-hmm.
And this voice, this culture that has been kept down for 20 years has suddenly found its voice. Like culture's like it's like grass. No matter how much concrete you're going to put on top of it, it will find its way through. And it's got a lot to say.
Hmm. Well, tell us a little bit about how you, where you came from and all that sort of stuff. I know you were born in, what, 1942, during World War II in England?
During World War II, yeah. Well, I was born in Bury St. Edmunds. That's in Suffolk, up in, sort of, you know, on the bum of the pig.
Mm-hmm.
And I was only 2 weeks old, and they sent my mum back to the middle of the air raids.
To have you, right?
Yeah, I spent the first 3 years of my life under a kitchen table. And
do you have any memory of that at all?
Vaguely. You know, I wasn't scared or anything because my parents sort of were pretty solid. And I sort of, my playground when I was a kid was a bomb site.
Hmm.
It was a big hole with bricks in it, you know. And there weren't no slides or swings in those days. But I sort of grew up in London and probably grew up in one of the best ages that England or most countries will ever see, because we'd won the war.
Right.
You know, we had no money, we were all on rations, but suddenly there was healthcare, there was plenty of work. It was, you know, it was going, it was booming. And suddenly they stopped the call-up. Men weren't called into the army anymore. So all of a sudden, for the first time ever, there were 18-year-old boys with money in their pockets walking the streets, you know, and driving cars. And then in came rock and roll, you know. Well, so, and the only thing the only worry anybody ever had was whether your girlfriend got pregnant. And then they brought out the pill. Well, talk about opening Pandora's box. They threw the lid away, you know what I mean?
So it was perfect.
Oh, it was a wonderful time. Yeah. Dennis Hopper lived in London in those times.
Yeah.
Now, Dennis knows where to find a good time.
Yeah. And you tagged along?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, what kind of a family did you grow up in? I mean, what did your dad do? What did your mom do?
My dad was a clerk.
A clerk, yeah.
Yeah. And he, and my mum was she was a cook.
Mm-hmm.
And then she was a nursery nurse. And it was pretty working class.
Happy family?
Very happy. I hated school. I was always very popular with the kids, but the teachers couldn't stand me.
Why?
I think I was a bit of a handful, you know.
Yeah.
Because my mum and dad both came from big families, and they wanted a big family, but until they had me, and that was the end of that. And I was the only child. I always wanted a little sister called Sophie, but yeah. She never came.
But you were an only child.
Yeah.
So you were a troublemaker in school?
Well, I could just see that. I was saucy. I could just see the funny side of things. You know what I mean? And they took themselves very seriously. Pomposity doesn't work with me.
So they were they were glad to see you go at the age of 15,
oh,
I
yes.
understand.
Oh, yeah. Well, I went back to school. I'd left school. I was working. I bought myself a suit and all the things. I strutted back into school to see the chaps. And the headmaster was standing at the top of the stairs. He said, "Take one more step, Hoskins, and I'll call the police." So, nice to see you too.
What about now? Do they claim you as one of their own now that you're a well-known actor?
What?
In Bob Hoskins' day at your school?
Well, not really. The only person that ever really meant anything to me there was a big Welshman called Mr. Jones, Dyer Jones. And he interested me in literature. I started to read, and he turned me into a total bookworm. And I still see him now occasionally in the pub. You know, he's retired now. He likes a bevy. And I'll go and have a bevy with him now again.
And a bevy for our audience is a drink. I got the hand signal on that. Well, you studied accounting for a while. I kind of can't imagine Bob Hoskins as
what
an accountant.
What a mistake.
What possessed you to think that you could be an accountant?
Well, it sounded like, it was about time I started doing something, being responsible. And one Monday morning, I remember all these certificates came through the door saying I was halfway there. I thought, I'm halfway to being everybody I hate. And I went into the boss's office, said, "Here, you pay for these, you can have them." And I left, and I got a boat to Europe. And I just hitched.
Bummed around,
and so that's what people did in those days. I was going to get to India, but I got to the Arab countries.
You worked on a kibbutz in Israel for a while.
Yeah, for 6 months. I went back there. It was the Jerusalem film. I can't remember what the film was. It wasn't 24/7. But anyway, I went back there to the Jerusalem Film Festival. And they arranged a trip for me to go back to the kibbutz where I was working. And Edna Capon, who was, when you go there, they give you a mother, to be, and there was Edna.
Wow. Still at the kibbutz?
Yeah. I had a little bob.
Did you ever take acting lessons or study with somebody or
look at
videotapes or something?
No. Well, when I started, they said, you've got to take elocution lessons, deportment classes, you got to learn to fence, you got to be, I said, wait a minute, hang on. I'm going to learn to talk like I don't, be like I'm not, walk like I don't. Where am I in the middle of this? And so I didn't take any lessons at all. But I learned to act by watching women.
Watching women act or watching women?
No, just watching women.
How so?
Well, it's sort of, the extraordinary thing is men, drama is about private moments. Drama is about things that you don't see. Drama is about things that people don't show. This is why people are employed to show them. It's a kind of catharsis. It's a kind of, a healing process. And men can't express themselves emotionally. Women can. I suppose it's because they've had to keep their mouth shut for thousands of years. You know what I mean? But women express themselves. You walk into a champagne dinner, right? And it's all laid out. And there's the lady. She's got a big smile on her face, but she's pissed. You know what I mean? There's no doubt. As soon as you walk in that room, but a guy. 3 weeks later, he said, "What's the matter with you?" Well, you did that. Well, why didn't you tell me? Why didn't you show me? And also, I suppose it comes from, it's got nothing to do with femininity either. It's just being able to express and not being afraid to express how they feel. Women live by feelings.
But what you're saying is that it's what, through body language, it's through words,
it's through honesty, basically. Men can't be that honest. They have
too much at stake.
Yeah, but I think so. I don't know what it is. You get guys sort of standing in a pub talking about, I was this and I was. wait a minute, I'm like, you know, I don't feel like that. That's not, nor do you really. What is this? You know?
We'll talk more with actor Bob Hoskins after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's continue our interview with actor Bob Hoskins. His films include Mona Lisa, The Long Good Friday, and 24/7. I asked him about acting with the animated characters in his 1988 film, Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
The thing about acting with cartoons is you got to be able to bounce off the walls the same as the cartoons. Right. And I suppose, you know, acrobatics and all that came into it. But the main thing was to sort of hallucinate. I had to learn to hallucinate without the benefit of drugs or booze or stuff. Just do the business.
How do you do that?
Well, I realised that that my daughter, she was Rosa. She was 3 at the time, and she had an invisible friend called Jeffrey. And I was often accused of sitting on Jeffrey, and I spent hours and hours playing with her. Because our imagination, when we're born, is right at the front, of our head. And kids can actually take it out and look at it. As we get older, it goes further and further back. And as we get really old, it comes back again. You see an old person mm-hmm. sitting there, they're talking to their imagination.
Right.
And I played with Rosa until it happened. But then I couldn't get rid of it. At the end, I had weasels coming out of all sorts of places. And even Rosie said, Dad, you've gone too far.
your little daughter was crazy.
But the funny thing with that, though, I must tell you, was Jack. That Roger Rabbit was the first time I ever made a film that my kids could see, you know? And I proudly sort of took my kids, and Jack was 3 when he saw it. And he came out and he wouldn't talk to me. It wouldn't have anything to do with me. And Jake, you know, what's the matter? It took me 2 weeks to get it out of him. And he reckoned that any father that had friends like Yosemite Sam and Daffy Duck and Bugs Bunny and didn't bring him home to meet his son was an arsehole. he wouldn't talk to me.
Well, Robert Zemeckis, who's the director, is quoted as saying that he chose you to play in this film because he essentially saw you as a cartoon.
Yeah.
I mean, that there was something about you that exuded cartoon. Was that insulting or
no,
you're joking.
Some of my best friends are cartoons. What are you saying? No. I've always loved cartoons. I suppose there is something cartoonic about me.
Yeah.
Well, it's what keeps me in work. It's my shape. Now, plastic surgery is the biggest benefit I've ever known. Like you go to Hollywood, and there's all these actors, and they all go to the same surgeon, and I'm sure this surgeon designed Action Man. You know I mean, because they all look like Action Man, and then you get a director who's sort of cast in a film, and there's all these Action Men, they all look exactly the same, and then this little short, you know, short, fat, airy sort of middle-aged man with a bald head walks in. He says, "Yeah, who's that?" Well, it's only me and Danny DeVito, let's face it.
That's right. With Roger Rabbit, though, you talked about having to conjure up all these images, these cartoons, with your imagination, but you were also working with puppets. I mean, I assume that there were things that the director was doing to try to make this real. I also read that there was something like 15 to 45 takes per scene in order to get all the, you know, all the movements right, all the reactions right.
Well, it'd never been done before, not like that.
Right.
And every single shot had to be discussed by about 30 people.
Mm. Is that frustrating as an actor?
No, it was incredible. I was one of that 30.
Right, right.
You know.
And taking apart, I guess, what, every
move?
Oh,
yeah. Move. Yeah, well, at lots of points there were people under the stage putting my feet in exactly the right position or had their hands up my back moving me in exactly the right position. Oh, I'd gone wrong.
Wow.
It would cost the company fortunes, so, because that wasn't computers, this was paint.
So you had to literally have yourself in exactly the right position.
Oh, yeah.
Did that, I don't know, did that inhibit you as an actor at all, to be so conscious of sort of where you were supposed to be?
I don't know. I wasn't conscious. I can't remember acting. I remember just sort of doing it, right, three steps that way, two steps that way, and talk to the rabbit there.
You know. A lot of bruises from this film?
Oh, I was covered.
Really?
Well, at the end of it, what with weasels coming out of the wall, Linda took me off to Antigua in the Caribbean. And I'm sitting on the beach and she said, "Babe, you're going to have to put a shirt on. You're covered in bruises. Everybody here thinks I beat you up."
You were.
Yeah, I was literally covered in bruises. So there I am, sitting in the sun in a shirt. And I had to put socks on because the dip at the end, dyed my feet bright green. So I had bright green feet covered in bruises. You know, I looked a real sight on that beach. I was out there.
Oh, that's great. I was watching Mona Lisa, which is a wonderful film, and you give a wonderful performance. And I wonder if that's one of your favorite films. Or was it an important film for you to do? I know you got an Oscar nomination.
It was. See, the point is, my experience is making them. I had a great time making it.
Right.
The thing is, what sort of I remember of making Mona Lisa, and the films like that, you suddenly get yourself into the middle of so much pain and so much sort of inner violence that at the time you think, I'm never going to get out of this alive, you know? And then, all right, you think, I'm doing myself serious damage here. But then you actually get out and you've done the reverse. You've actually, you know, healed yourself. It's like a cleansing process. Mm-hmm. But my memory is the pain.
And the pain that comes out of certainly the pain of this character, but also the violence, because we see that even in 24/7, there's a extremely violent scene there. And watching you, I won't give too much away, but literally beating somebody, it's scary to watch. Is it scary to do?
Well, that one particularly was, it couldn't be heroic. It had to be ugly. It had to make the audience feel uncomfortable, and we tried to choreograph it, and it looked like something out of John Wayne.
Oh.
And so, Bruce, who plays the father, is in fact a very nice man.
And this is in 24/7.
Yeah, and he said, "Bob, we're just going to have to do it." I said, "Bruce, you know, you forget it. We're going to get hurt." He said,
"You mean you're going to have to hit me?
We're going to have to do it." And we did. We spent all afternoon doing it. And at the end of the afternoon, I had a broken hand. He had a broken hand. He had a fractured collarbone and two cracked ribs. And I took him to the hospital, and we both got patched up. And then we went to the pub and drank until it was painless.
So what we're seeing, and I'm looking at you with this shock on my face, what we're seeing then in the film is you beating this
guy. It's the real thing.
It's the real thing.
Yeah.
But so as an actor, though, how do you get yourself into character so that you're not play acting this? You're really hitting somebody. How do you make?
Well, it's, I don't know.
You have to go someplace else.
I can't explain acting.
Right. When you see that scene, though, what's the impact when you see that?
Well, it makes you feel sick.
Right.
Hopefully.
Right.
We didn't want to make it attractive.
Right. But as you see it and you know what you're doing, do you wince and grimace and kind of?
Yes, I did. Yes.
Actor Bob Hoskins, he recently appeared in Cousin Bet and 24/7. His upcoming film is The Live Virgin. Coming up, new music to old lyrics. Folk singer Billy Bragg performs Woody Guthrie. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. In 1995, Woody Guthrie's daughter Nora approached the British folk singer-songwriter Billy Bragg with a collection of lyrics her father had written but never set to music. Bragg asked the American band Wilco to help him compose melodies and record a batch of these previously unheard Guthrie songs. The result is Mermaid Avenue. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
Last night or the night before that, I won't say which night. A seaman friend of mine, I'll not say which seaman, walked up to a big old building. I won't say which building, and would not have walked up the stairs, not to say which stairs, if it had not been two girls.
Billy Bragg has said in interviews that when Nora Guthrie came to him with her father's lyrics and asked him to write music for them, he immediately said, "That's Bob Dylan's job, not mine." You can understand what he meant. As Guthrie's greatest disciple, Dylan might have more authority to do this task, but the force of Dylan's personality might also have obliterated Guthrie's words in a way that Billy Bragg's never does. And Bragg, as a thoughtful, politically minded folky in the Guthrie tradition, had the right instinct in enlisting an American band like Wilco, which regularly mixes rock, folk, and country in its own compositions. Together, they've come up with music that showcases Guthrie's words without being intimidated or modest or too laid back. That's Wilco's Jeff Tweedy singing Woody Guthrie's genially irreligious anti-government novelty tune, Christ for President. The song has its serious socialist points to make and forces a neat comparison between corrupt politicians and the biblical money changers whose tables Jesus overturned. One of the surprises on this collection is how open Guthrie was to all sorts of music. In the margin to the words of one song, Guthrie scrawled the comment, "Supersonic Boogie." That's certainly what another tune here, Hoodoo Voodoo, sounds like. Bragg points out that despite his Dust Bowl oaky image, Woody Guthrie spent the last half of his life on the East Coast, in New York no less. Mermaid Avenue is the name of the street in Brooklyn where he lived. And much of the music here has a worldly, city-fied liveliness.
I guess I planted some long ocean seed of a song went down inside me long ago. Song, it don't compare with all your big ones you hear everywhere. But when it dawns, way in the back of your mind, the big ones are made up by the little kind. Union song, union battle, all added up, what is all what we got now? Union song.
This collection does everyone proud. It gives Bragg a platform to connect with an audience beyond his cult. It gives Wilco a shot of energy for a band that can slacken into lassitude. Most of all, it gives us a more complete picture of Woody Guthrie, as fiercely romantic as he was political, as likely to write a musical mash note to Ingrid Bergman as to call for the smashing of the capitalist state.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Mermaid Avenue by Billy Bragg and Wilco.
Ingrid Bergman, Ingrid Bergman, let's go make a picture on the island of Stromboli. Ingrid Bergman, Ingrid Bergman, you're so pretty, you'd make any mountain quiver, you'd make fire fly from the crater. Ingrid Bergman, this old mountain, it's been waiting all its life for you to work it, for your hand to touch its hard rock. Ingrid Bergman, Ingrid Bergman, if you walk across my camera, I will flash the world your story, I will pay you more than money. Ingrid Bergman, not by pennies, dimes, nor quarters, but with happy sons and daughters, and they'll sing around Stromboli. Ingrid Bergman, this old mountain, it's been waiting all its life for you to work it, for your hand to touch its hard rock. Ingrid Bergman, Ingrid Bergman.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Bob Purdick, Audrey Bentham, Fred Snyder, and Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moss, Cowain.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.